Welcome to the ABCA's podcast. I'm your host, Ryan Brownlee. New ABCA podcast sponsor Driveline are longtime friends, and I've used many of their products when I was coaching in the youth camps now. If you want to truly optimize your pitcher's workload, Pulse from Driveline Baseball takes simple pitch counts to the next level. Pulse is a wearable sensor that precisely measures every throw your pitchers make on a daily basis. Pulse tracks both throw count and throw intensity. Trusted by MLB organizations like the Cincinnati Reds, elite college programs, and individual athletes at all levels, Pulse is changing the way throwing workload is managed. With the Pulse Team dashboard, you'll be able to make data-driven usage decisions to optimize training and injury prevention for your entire team. Visit drivelinebaseball.com/pulse to revolutionize your pitching staff's development and health today. This episode is sponsored by Netting Pros. Netting professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Netting Professionals specializes in the design, fabrication, and installation of custom netting for backstops, batting cages, dugouts, BP screens, and ball carts. They also design and install digital graphic wall padding, windscreen, turf, turf protectors, dugout benches, dugout cubbies, and more. Netting Professionals is an official partner of the ABCA and continues to provide quality products and services to many high school, college, and professional fields, facilities, and stadiums throughout the country. Netting Professionals are improving programs one facility at a time. Contact them today at 844-620-2707 or info@nettingpros.com. Visit them online at www.nettingpros.com or check out Netting Pros on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn for all their latest products and projects. Make sure to let CEO Will Miner know that the ABCA sent you. Now on to the podcast. Next up on the ABCA podcast is ABCA Division III Coach of the Year, Pete Egbert. Egbert is heading into his 18th season as the head coach at Misericordia University, leading the Cougars to their first national championship this season. His back-to-back appearances for the Cougars after competing in Cedar Rapids last year, and they also had an appearance in 2018. Misericordia went 41-11 and 19-2 in conference play this season. Egbert is closing in on 600 wins in 21 seasons as a head coach at Fitchburg and Misericordia. Egbert has been named Conference Coach of the Year six times and was the 2023 ABCA Regional Coach of the Year. Misericordia plays a really good style of baseball, putting pressure on the defense, pitching at an elite level, and taking care of the ball defensively. Let's welcome Pete Egbert to the podcast. Here with Pete Egbert, ABCA A-Tech Division III Coach of the Year from Misericordia, won their first national championship, but 44-11. 19-2 in conference, but heading into your 18th season as head coach. Pete, thanks for jumping on with me.
Thanks for having me.
I feel like we know each other a little bit now. We got to connect in Iowa and then Ohio again, and I'm so happy for you. But what'd you think of the last 2 years with the fields that we're in at the last 2 years?
Yeah, really good. You know, just a great experience. You know, we were fortunate. We've been in it three times, and we've been fortunate to be at three different locations. We were the last year of Appleton, and then we got to experience Iowa and got to experience Ohio. So all of that has been fun for our program and our guys, too. And just the level of competition is really good. I feel like, you know, usually there's anywhere around 30 to 40 teams at the Division III level that have a legitimate shot of getting there. And I thought this year there were some teams that weren't there that could have been there, should have been there, we're talented enough to be there, certainly. So we consider ourselves really fortunate.
Is that the cool thing with Division III? Because there's more than just a handful of schools that have an opportunity to get there every year, because there's new schools every year that get there.
Yeah, and so we talk about that from a recruiting standpoint, and one of the things that we're trying to sell to student athletes, let's be honest, in this part of the country, most of the Division I schools really don't have a legitimate chance to get there, whereas at the Division II and Division III levels, they do. And Stony Brook was an anomaly a few years back, and certainly there are some good, fun Division I stories occasionally, but now, especially with what's going on at the higher levels and all the money that's out there, it's going to be less of a chance for certain Division One schools. So yeah, at the Division Three level, really fun for on any given year. You just don't know who could get there, and there are some really good programs and some coaches that have built their things up pretty well. But you still have to play well, and I think that goes at every level. But certainly, there's more opportunity at the Division Three level, I think, to get there.
Coming out of the fall, did you feel like you had an opportunity to get back?
You never know. I mean, it's so darn hard to get there. And this is the first year we had 6 grad students on our roster with COVID and everything else going on. So they were hungry and they came back for another chance to get there. They had been there the year before. And so that was certainly in the back of my mind. But I'm kind of old school in that I put a lot of emphasis on the regular season. And I think the best team comes out of the long regular season. So we emphasize that. And that's our first step. And then once you get into playoff time, you know, so many things have to go your way. You've got to get fortunate. You've got to get hot at the right time. And we were just fortunate that it worked out for us this year.
Yeah, and we talked about that in Ohio. You guys do play a really challenging early schedule before you get into conference play.
Yeah, that's just something that's kind of evolved over the years. I mean, to me, just the old adage, you've got to beat the best to be the best. So we're going to go out and load up our first 15 non-conference games against whoever we can find within reasons to do that, and that's worked for us.
When did you switch that?
When I first got to Ms. Recordia, the program wasn't as strong, so we had to be careful early on. But a few years in, when we started to build it, we always had Shenandoah to open the season because of a pre-existing relationship before I got here. So that was always a really good test where you go down and play Shenandoah. And always, you know, the northern schools think they're at a little bit of a disadvantage because you're coming out of the gym and you're facing the southern schools who have already been on the field. But it is what it is. I mean, you know, it doesn't really matter. It was hard to get other teams on the schedule. I mean, everybody wants to play a good schedule. So you had to have a certain record and have some good wins on your schedule in order to attract some of the other better teams. And then we take a trip to Florida every year at the start of March. And that became, okay, let's go where the best teams are. If we want to really put a run together and we want to be good at the end of the season, we've got to challenge ourselves early. So we've done that and put together some good Florida trips.
Have you been able to reflect much? I know recruiting's a big deal in the summertime. Have you been able to reflect much on the season?
I've tried. You know, it's funny. As soon as you win, everybody says congratulations. And then they say, okay, so we expect to see you back there next year, or what's happening next year, or how much do you lose, or whatever. And I think that's just natural. I've been fighting really, really hard against that and just trying to enjoy this as best as I can. I told myself when it happened, I'd get to July 1st and try and enjoy it and then start focusing on the next year. And then I got to July 1st. First, and I said, well, maybe I should try and enjoy it a little bit more because I don't know if it's going to happen again. So I've tried to enjoy it, but at the same time, you are recruiting and back out on the road. And when you play longer into the season, you get caught behind from a recruiting standpoint. But I'm really fortunate. I've got some great assistant coaches who have helped us a lot. Garrett Demaray has been here for a few years now, and Joe Horn is our new graduate assistant, and David McCurry has been out on the road, and Steve Holmes does. So I have some good support, and we have more eyes out on the road, so it's made it a little bit easier.
For you, since you do have a little bit of turnover here and there with assistants, have your responsibilities stayed the same with the program, or have you had to switch as you hire new guys?
Yeah, when we hire new guys, typically I try and get their strengths and plug them into what we think is best, and then I fill the gaps. So my role has changed over the years. I was fortunate to have a pitching coach, David Gargone, here for 12 years, so he took the pitchers for the vast majority of times. But there are years where I've been with the pitchers, years I've been with the catchers, outfielders, infielders. I mean, we just kind of plug it in. But now, once you get more consistent with assistant coaches, and assistant coaches have been there for 3, 4, 5 years, I also recognize that they're not going to be with us forever. And for me, it's really important to build their resume as they want to become head coaches. If they're an infield guy, they've got to start working with some different groups and get familiar with some different areas to make themselves better candidates to be head coaches. Because again, at our level, you can't specialize. You've got to master everything.
Does that keep it fresh for you, though? Because, no, okay, I may have get to coach something else here in a little bit.
Yeah, it does. It does. And just philosophically, the other thing that we do, even if our guys do have specific positions that they work with most of the time, but there are days where we show up to practice and we just switch it around. And I want guys to have a different set of eyes on some different players. I think there's value in that for our players, and I think there's value in that for our coaches.
And hearing some different voices helps every once in a while too, from a retention standpoint.
No question. No question.
Now, do you have to talk to them about language as far as not, but as far as trying to keep messaging concise? I think we run into that issue as baseball coaches where maybe the terminology might be a little bit different. You might be saying the same thing, but do you even really care about that?
No, I don't really, because I think we are all trying to teach the same thing. And sometimes there's just different phrases or trigger words that the players respond to. I'm trying to say things one way and it doesn't make sense. And then an assistant coach steps in and says the exact same thing with different verbiage. And all of a sudden it clicks and makes sense. So again, I think there's some value in that too.
You had one All-American. Do you feel like the strength of your team was kind of strength in numbers? Because you had great numbers up and down your roster.
Yeah, and right, that's the glory of team sports. I mean, you can't rely on the same guy all the time. Our leadoff hitter, Garrett McElhaney, was really the pulse of our team. I mean, he set the tone for us on offense, but we had so many guys throughout the course of the season, throughout the playoffs and the World Series. I mean, our 8 and our 9 hitter contributed a ton in the World Series, and you need to be able to do that. On the mound, Joe Valenti was our ace all year long, but we got consistent performances from a ton of other guys throughout. And yeah, I mean, you need so many guys to step up in order to win at a high level.
I mean, and it seems like you use a majority of your roster too.
Yeah, we do. I mean, it's tough. I mean, you know, I tell the administration all the time, I mean, baseball is different, right? Softball is different. You can't shuffle people in like many of the other sports do. Once you substitute, there is no getting them back. So you try and get guys involved, but you have to be careful as well. And you try and use certain skill sets. So, you know, we like to run a lot and we like to put pressure. So there are some opportunities for some guys to get on the bases or some defensive specialist types of guys. I'm not really a matchup guy in the bullpen, lefty, lefty, righty, righty. To me, it's more best available guy. But when you go deep in tournaments, I mean, we played 8 games in 7 days, and in the conference tournament, you go deep. And sometimes when you get rainouts in the regular season, you go deep. So you've got to use more of your pitchers in certain spots. So we try and get as many guys as we can involved, and I think that helps for future years as well.
You discuss that with your pitchers as far as, okay, once we get in the game, here's probably who I feel might go first? Or is it just gut feel for you on that?
I'm a gut guy more than anything else. You know, there, from a pitching standpoint, we'll list the guys who are available, who we know are available. And then there are a bunch of guys that we might not list based on when they threw last. And it's up to them to come to us and tell us whether or not they're strong enough or available that day. And then roles evolve and roles always change. Again, at our level, sometimes you use a starter in relief at playoff time or, you know, vice versa. That always changes. So I think the best available guy, you know, has just worked well for us regardless of what the role is. So I like guys to be familiar with coming out of the bullpen and having to heat up hot or getting that extra time as a starter. So we try and put them in those situations in the fall so that they have some flexibility in the spring.
Your recruiting base similar to when you first got there? Or has it opened up with the amount of success you all have had?
It's been interesting the last few months. I would say that more people are reaching out to us from a more national standpoint than before. We used to be pretty regional. We used to recruit from mostly within 3 hours or so. And now we're getting guys from Florida and Texas and California and Hawaii reaching out to us, whether or not they're actual fits. We still to be determined. We've got to figure that out. But yeah, there are more guys reaching out.
Do you're getting not, I mean, you got some time before. That's a benefit of not starting school right away, is because you've got a little bit of a buffer here in case you needed to add some guys late. So do you have like a stop from school? Because I know some of the better schools out there, they'll put a stop like after this point, you can't get anybody into school anymore.
The school does have rolling admissions. I mean, we can get guys in up until the end of August, but we're not really a school where we're getting a lot of transfers in and out. Most of the, obviously, the seniors in high school or will be freshmen have made up their minds unless something really weird happens. So those are isolated scenarios. To me, one of the things that I recognize this year is critically important. I'm not a huge fan of what's going on in the industry right now with guys shuffling and moving in and out. And I know that's a real tough thing for coaches, and everybody's always looking for talent. But this year, more than any, really proved to me how much culture is important and how much leadership is important. And everybody talks about it, but it's hard to pinpoint how much value there really is on that stuff. But for us, our grad students who had been around the program and who had known us inside and out made it really easy for our coaching staff this year because they ran themselves. And when you're shuffling guys in and out and they don't really know the expectations year in and year out, that makes it more and more difficult. So for me, I want to get a guy for 4 years, keep him for 4 years. And with that, we don't do a lot of late shuffling.
Same thing happened with Evansville, where I graduated from. They almost beat Tennessee in the Super Regionals because they had guys that had been around for 5 and 6 years.
Yeah. So how do you value that? You don't say, oh, well, that turns into 4 wins or 6 wins that you don't really know. But again, this year, more than any, proved to me, I don't know that we were the most talented.
I think it keeps you more away from sliding. Like, maybe not wins, but I think it keeps you from going into extended slumps.
Yeah, that's a great point. I had never really considered that. That's a great point. I mean, there are so many things, just everything that happens, not only on the field, but off the field, and all the expectations that you have. Those guys just know. So if you have a younger guy that's not meeting those expectations, the older guys can get them in line and straighten them out even well before it gets to the coaching staff.
Did you have anybody that had a great year that you weren't really expecting to coming out of the fall?
So many guys really stepped up for us. Matt Lanzendorfer was our closer, who had kind of battled injury and not a ton of success throughout his career. And he wasn't even available to us at the start of the year, but he really stepped up big and pitched in 4 games in the World Series, closed some games out, and then started a game for us. Connor Marinac was our shortstop pitcher. He was always super talented, but just had never really reached his maximum potential until this year, and he became the National Player of the Year. There were so many guys. Jason Sanfilippo moved from third base to first base, and I think that made him more valuable. And then our ace, Joe Valenti, was always the steady rock for us all throughout his career, but he was never a true ace until this year. So those guys at the highest level really stepped up for us. And then there were so many other guys, Gabe Bond and Brock Bollinger and Jack Regany. I mean, just all role guys who really stepped up and had some key performances throughout the course of the year.
Those guys having better years on the mound, was that just development or did they tighten things up? I know maybe obviously staying healthy too helps, but were those just small things that they made adjustments from the year before?
I think it was a combination of a lot of things. We talked about that. We talked about in years prior to the last 2 or 3, we always had a true ace on the staff. And the past 2 or 3 years, we didn't really have that true ace. So we had talked about that. And, hey, somebody needs to step up. We're talented enough for somebody to step up and be that true guy. We had a pitching coach change. Billy Gregory came in to work with our pitchers. And I think once we got through the fall and they learned from him a little bit, the expectations were outlined there, and I think he did a great job with our pitchers. And then I think there was just an internal competition, which is something that we try to create. You know, Friday's guy pitches well, comes off and looks at Saturday's guys and is like, top that. And then Saturday's guys are like, okay, give me the ball. I'm going to try and top it. And that's kind of the environment that we want. So I think a lot of that happened this year.
And you guys got rolling once you got into conference play. And is that part of the tougher schedule for you? As you know, it may be a little bumpy in the beginning, but once we get to conference play, I know we're going to be ready because we played a battle-tested schedule.
Yeah, that's the goal. And then our conference has really changed in the last 3 or 4 years. The additions of Stevens and Arcadia and Lebanon Valley with DeSales and us, and we've got, you know, 5 or 6 teams, and there are some teams that are up and coming with some new coaching changes and some added facilities that you can't walk on anymore either. I mean, we got a really, really black and blue conference. I feel like our conference, you know, is one of the top 5 or 6 in the country at our level. So you've got to be battle tested and ready for that conference schedule. There are no gimmies.
Was your prep any different this year in Ohio as opposed to Iowa?
The prep wasn't different. Some of the talks were different in terms of, okay, we've been here before. Not good enough just to win one game. You know, we're going to go try and, you know, do some damage and win it all. And, we think that we have a shot to do that, but we also had asked our guys to be true to what we are. We play the game differently than most. We recognize that. And I think we had gotten away from that at tournament time or World Series time in years past, where as this year we made an emphasis and said, hey, you know, we got to stick with who we are. This is how we got here. This is what's going to get us there. And I think our guys executed, you know, kind of our game. And it was pretty obvious to everybody that was watching us that we played the game differently than most. Yeah.
Because I thought physically Whitewater was the most physical team in that tournament, but pro Paul Bark, your guy's skill set plays extremely well in a ballpark like that, because you're not always going to be able to hit home runs in that park.
Yeah, and not just Whitewater. I mean, our guys kind of take pride in that. I mean, when we line up for the national anthem, we're never the more physical team. Never. Even in conference, even at the beginning of the year, that's just the way that we're built. So we recognize that we've got to play differently. And I think there's some room for that. We proved, hopefully, that there's some room for that. But yeah, I mean, Whitewater was more physical. Lynchburg was really physical. Endicott and Salve were really physical. They're just built different. And when I first got here, we tried to get some of those guys and we just weren't successful doing it. So we had to find a different way to try it. And this has worked for us.
Yeah. And I love it because it's an outlier and you have a chance to go out and out-execute teams. And you get guys that have a chip on their shoulder, too, from a recruiting standpoint.
Yeah, so we talk about that. And Garrett McElhaney is a great example. I mean, the kid's a little left-handed 5'3 guy. He doesn't have a great arm, but he just runs. And when he went out and played in the summer, he's playing with guys from Power 5 programs and other Division I programs. And he's like, hey, I'm just as good as these guys, but I might not look as good in the uniform. So yeah, he does have a chip on his shoulder and that's kind of another blue collar approach that we have. And we want our guys to take pride in that and realize, hey, there is more than one way to do it. So we want them to execute those things at a high level, but we want them to understand what we're asking them to do and then just do as good a job as they can of executing.
And that is the benefit of sending guys out for summer baseball, because mine was the same way with sending our guys out, because they weren't allowed to come back home unless they were injured. And I think from a smaller school kid, you see guys from bigger schools like that, and then you're like, I play way harder than those guys. And I show up every day, and those guys are tired in the middle of the summer, and they're ready to go home. I was like, it's just a mentality that you build with summer baseball with guys.
Yeah, and that's I take pride in that when I hear from a summer coach after we've sent a guy, and he says, hey, I'll take a Misericordia guy any day of the week just because of those intangibles. Yeah.
Big fan of the academic and athletic piece at Division III, I am. And what are your thoughts on that? Because I think it's the purest. I think it's the purest form that we have still.
Yeah. So as a young assistant, I was fortunate enough to work at Division I, II, and III, and then I settled on III for a lot of reasons. I can't speak to what's going on really at the Division I or II levels because I haven't been there in over 20 years now. But I've dedicated my career to Division III. I really believe in the student athlete, and I think that not only can you have a great amount of success in the classroom, and you can also have a great amount of success on the field. I also like that Division III allows you to get involved with other things on campus and in the community, and you have time to do those other things, because that's part of our sell also, is that those things help round out your resume, those things help build your network, so that when baseball does end at some point in your career, you've got some other things to go to. So that's other things that I like about the Division III model.
With guys coming in the fall, how often do you meet with them individually, or do you meet with them individually at all in the fall?
So after our team meeting, it's not like set and standard. It's more my office is located in our fitness center, and they can come in and out, and just it's more natural meeting type of thing than set meetings. Although we do keep a really close eye on our incoming freshmen for the first 4 to 6 weeks. We have some individual meetings with them. We have some small group meetings with them just to make sure that they're getting off to the right start. But then after the fall, that's really the first mandated meeting where you know, I'll sit down with each of them and we'll talk about evaluation of the fall. But I'd rather, over the years, I used to have 4 mandated meetings with our guys prior to and after both traditional and non-traditional seasons. I've gotten away from that, and I just want the meetings to be more, you know, lunchroom meetings or before practice meetings or come into the office and, you know, just have fun, you know, type of things. And I think that's worked better for us.
With your evaluation process coming out of the fall, is that the coaches evaluating players or the players evaluate themselves? What's your evaluation process like coming out of the fall?
Yeah, both. When we have that end of the fall meeting, I give our players the first opportunity to talk. And I just ask them an open-ended question and say, go. And I want their evaluation of themselves, the team. I would tell you that we're working with athletes that are mature enough where almost always they recognize what they're doing well and where they need to improve. So very rarely am I adding too much to what they're saying. Once in a while, I'll challenge them in different ways. But, you know, if a guy needs to get more physical or stronger, if a guy needs a certain mechanical adjustment, they know that by that point. So, you know, they identify those things. So the fall meetings are important for me just to get a better understanding of the team dynamic. Sometimes I miss some stuff. So if guys are coming in and giving me, hey, well, this was going on or this was going on, and I hear that, you know, 4, 5, or 6 times, that becomes a theme, and then that's something that we can address.
Then how do you handle, I mean, you played for a long time. How'd you handle exit interviews with guys after you're done?
They wanted to get home.
Way to go, players.
We let them go. Yes. They had been on campus for a month without anything else going on. And yes. It was really funny, actually. So we're on the bus ride back from Ohio, and we're scheduled to get in at 2:00 in the morning, and we get in, and I said, guys, I got good news and bad news, and the good news is that they're holding a celebration for us tomorrow at the field. The bad news is it's 10:00 in the morning, and they're kind of grumbling. They're like, oh man, what? There's going to be 20 people there. This isn't going to be worth our while. And we showed up, and there were like 300 or 400 people there at the field, and it was a kind of cool celebration. But right after that, see you later. I mean, they were gone. So the exit interviews were over the phone, unfortunately. We got a few local guys that we did, and I gave them the option if they wanted to do it in person, they could stay back for a day or two and do that. So I had maybe 8 or 10 guys take advantage of that, but most of them were on the phone, which is not an ideal scenario.
I would try to do it on the bus. That was like, because we'd have some long bus rides back just for the guys that had to get out and get to summer ball. I would try to get those guys taken care of on the bus just so when we got home, they could just get out.
I thought about doing that. I just didn't pull the trigger.
Not
so maybe
you,
next
man.
Time.
Not coming off a national championship.
I wanted them to enjoy that bus ride. I didn't want to have. I didn't want them hearing from me that they needed to do A, B, or C yes. over the summer.
Yep. How do you feel like some of the Division I proposed rules might trickle down to you all?
I don't know yet. You know, we talked when COVID happened that maybe the quality of baseball would get better at the Division III level. And to be very frank, I'm not so sure that that happened.
I see almost every championship. It's pretty good. I'm the one person out of everyone, probably, and me and JR, because we do cover all the levels. I see just about every level where your guys' brand of baseball is good. It is.
No, it is good. It is good. But what the other part of it that's going on is our best players aren't staying anymore.
Yeah.
Right. So the guys who were our best players and maybe all Americans as freshmen and sophomores used to stay for 4 years, and that would make our level of baseball better. But now those guys are leaving and those guys are going up a level. So yeah, the roster limits might help us and maybe get some guys on the front end, but then when they get to us and have success, there's likelihood or chance that they could leave also. So I don't really know how it's all going to shake out. And we talked before we got on. I mean, I personally think the landscape of college athletics is going to change drastically in the next 5 or 8 years. And I don't know exactly which way it's going to go, but there are going to be some interesting changes here coming up.
I just think football needs to go do their own thing. Just let Division I football go do their own thing. I'm a traditionalist when it comes to teams. So I want region teams playing each other back. I want all the region teams, the competitive region teams that always played against each other. I want all those back, but I don't think we'll ever get back to that. I hope we do, but I think football should just go do their own thing and then let everybody else go back to the way it was.
Yeah, it's a good point. It's a good point. The one thing I kind of do like, I'm old school like you, where the regional matchups always were cool. I think the NCAA at our level anyway has done a good job of mixing those, so it's not the same exact teams in the same regional every year, and they've sent teams, you know, to different spots.
And I'm talking I'm talking more conference and non-conference. I think the regional format is perfect. I love that almost everybody's got super regionals now too. Like, I love that format. I'm talking regular season, where hopefully we can get back to where teams are, because I'm not sure the budgets can handle the amount of travel. Now, I've said this a couple times, the West Coast schools are going to figure out what it's been like to be in the Midwest and the upper Midwest from a travel standpoint, and the Northeast, because that's a long way to go, and then it's a long way to try to get back and have your players go to class. And that's for all sports. They're going to have to do it.
Yeah, the West Coast is going to be interesting to see what goes on there. Yeah, I agree with you.
Because going out that way is fine, but when you got to come back, it's a lot on kids from go west to east with the time change. It's a lot.
Yeah, and those schools are making multiple trips now.
Yes.
Right? Maybe it was just one or two a year, and now it's multiple trips. So that's going to take its toll.
How'd you get to Fitchburg?
So I went to grad school at Springfield College, and there was a guy who I met there, Todd Soulier, who was in the athletic training program, who was a year ahead of me, and he got the athletic training job at Fitchburg. And then when I graduated from Fitchburg, the baseball job opened, and he called me and asked if I was interested. So, yeah, that was a cool experience. That was my first head coaching experience, and very thankful. I've kept in touch with a lot of those Fitchburg guys over the years, so that's been fun.
How do you raise the expectations of a program?
I don't know. If you figure it out, let me know.
Come on now.
I don't know. I just, you know, when we first got here, you know, things were different. Things were different, and the facilities were different, and the expectations were different. And then, you know, with some winning and with some success, that just changes things, and then facilities change. And then even on campus, there's some good pressure. Our women's soccer program is very good, and the baseball guys and the women's soccer team have a very close relationship. And there's always some back and forth with those two teams, you know, who's going to do better this year. And we've got some other teams as well that are, so I don't know. And then I just think it's built up from within. And then guys during the recruiting process, just they come and they have certain expectations, but you've got to be wary of that as well, right? You don't just show up and have success. It takes a lot of work to get there. So I don't want to become complacent, and we're always trying to find new ways to challenge our guys.
It's a slow burn, I think, over time. It's just a slow burn on that. It's one of those things where you make those gradual changes over time, and then you look up, and it's like, but that's credit to you that you've been there that long too. You can do that as a coach when you've stayed at a place as long as you have, where you can get that slow burn where not everybody gets that opportunity.
Yeah, but you have to, professionally, at least for me, I've had to find different ways to challenge myself and not continue to go through the same routine. And I've done that in a variety of ways. And I think I've been really fortunate to bring some really bright young assistant coaches in who have challenged me. And in certain ways, I've given them opportunities to impact the program and try things differently and try things that are new and kind of evolve. And that keeps me fresh as well.
How do you develop that mentality? Because I think that's a phenomenal mentality. How do you develop that mentality where you're continuously challenging yourself?
It's really hard. I have type A personality. I like things to be very scripted. I like routine, but I also don't like to lose. And I also value the people that are around me. So I think in order to show them that they have value, you have to respect them. You have to respect their opinions. You have to allow them to bring information into the program. I'm really careful because there's so much information out there right now. I'm really careful about what comes into the program. I know that every single one of our student athletes is home for the summer, and they're, you know, looking at whatever they're looking at. And sometimes it always doesn't mesh with what we do, but there's nothing wrong with that. Right. I mean, that's okay. But yeah, I mean, again, just making sure that you have the right hires and you're bringing the right student athletes in that know, and they want to challenge themselves. And that's what we talk about during the recruiting process. Like, if you don't want to be challenged, don't come to this program. This is not a good program for you. I want to challenge you, but I also want you to challenge me, as long as it's done in the right way.
How do you get them to understand that there is healthy confrontation in that, an open conversation? I think we're so divisive right now in America, where people are trying to choose sides, and there's so much gray area when it comes to development, that I think it's an open conversation. But if we don't agree, it doesn't mean that I don't like you or we're mortal enemies. How do you get to that point where they understand it? It's healthy confrontation.
Really difficult in this day and age, right? Where everybody needs to be liked. And although the country is very divisive, everybody also wants to have friends, and everybody wants to be liked and wants their opinion appreciated and respected. And I think that's the key, right? And I say this in my own house. I mean, we're not always going to have the same opinions, but that's what makes us stronger, right? I mean, if we all had the same opinions, then we wouldn't be pretty good. So we've got to have different opinions. And at the end of the day, you might not agree, but you've got to respect where somebody's coming from. And then I tell my guys, and, you know, this is just the unfortunate thing that they have to deal with, and they're going to deal with it in their entire lives until they become bosses. You know, I'm going to make hundreds of thousands of decisions this year, and you're not going to agree with every single one of them, but I'm not going to ask that you respect those. And if you do have a disagreement, come into the office, let's talk about it. I am willing to change. And I had a grad student come into the office this year, and he knows the way that we wanted to pitch, and that wasn't really working for him. And finally, in his fifth year, he comes in and he says, "Hey, can we try this maybe?" And I was like, "Okay, tell me why. What's going on?" He's like, "Oh, I just feel like if I do this or this, maybe a little bit differently." Okay, well, come tell me that. Let's give it a shot, because right now you're not performing where either of us think that you're, you know, your level is. So yeah, we need to try something different. So if you have some new ideas, let's do that. But I'm also, if it's working, don't fix it, right? Like, if it ain't broke. So we'll keep doing that. And I'm just
as
superstitious
as the next. And that's an amazing thing, though, with players, is once they do take ownership of that, it's the light bulb goes on for them, because obviously you're with your coaches, but if you feel like it's going to work for a player and they feel like they're taking ownership of it, it's amazing how much quicker that development curve shortens.
I think so. And that's been a main staple of our strength program. We have a base strength program that we want pitchers to do, a base program that position players do. But we also recognize that they're all different based on their experience, their position, their makeup, their body, their testing results. So we ask them to help build their program by bringing things in that we think that they need. Now, usually the freshmen want to do more of what they're good at, right? And then we say, okay, well, that's not what we're asking you to do. I mean, if you're good at pull-ups, you don't need to do more pull-ups. We need you to do, you know, where you're deficient and really attack your weaknesses. So there's some education there. But once they recognize that, we want them to bring things into their strength program. We want them to bring things into the things that we're doing. There are some rules that we have. There are some things that I really don't like for them to be doing, but there are things that I want them to be able to have some flexibility to bring in, because I think you're right. You know, I think the learning curve is faster when they do that.
Yeah. I built my own program when I was in college. Now, with our strength coach, but I'll tell you what, because I built that thing, I did it every day. Because
of course.
I built it. Because I had more.
Yeah, of course.
Because I built it. Is that a benefit of you being the fitness director?
I don't know. So we have a strength coach, but Coach Demaray, myself, and then I'm also really lucky. I've got three or four guys who have played for us who are in that industry. So really, it's a team effort where six or seven of us kind of design the program. But that's another area where things are always changing, right? There's always new fads and always new things going on. So you've got to stay on top of it. And I think you've got to give the players some of the new stuff. But some of the new stuff is new just for the sake of being new. It's not really productive. It just looks cool.
Someone's
right?
trying to sell it is what it
right,
is.
Right, right.
Someone's trying
right.
to sell it.
Right. So, you know, you've got to stick to me with some of the basic principles in that field. But you've got to allow some individual freedom for them to bring some new things in and try some new things, too.
Will that be your message to the team this fall? Obviously, last year was great. But especially for the new guys, like, we got to get back to work here.
Yeah, you know, I've talked to a handful of people about that. They say getting to the top is really hard, but staying on top is even harder. So I haven't figured out quite how we're going to do that. I mean, we lose a ton. We lose a ton. So there's no question we're going to need some young guys to step in and some new guys to step in. We're going to have a completely different look. And then, you know, again, because I'm kind of an old soul that way, we're going to get back to, hey, let's prioritize the conference. Let's make sure that we're taking care of business there. Nothing is given, and we're going to get everybody's best, and everybody's going to be gunning for us, and we know that. So we've got to figure out how to be mature enough to handle that.
Being in Northern School, how do you get your arms ready for the spring when they get back?
So when they changed the rules last year, I think that helped us a lot. We didn't take all 24 in the fall. We only took 18 days in the fall, and we left 6 days early in the spring. And the way we did it is we brought pitchers in, day one pitchers, and then day two pitchers, and then we had a day off. And then we brought group one and group two back, and then a day off, and then group one and group two back. So they had three bullpens to kind of get their arm strength going prior. But I would say that from a time standpoint, there wasn't a lot more time. I still believe in 60 days off without throwing a baseball. So after our fall, I give our pitchers 60 days where I don't want them to have a ball in hand. So they're really not starting to amp up until second week of December or so. So at the outset in mid to late January, it was just more supervision from us than there had been in the past. And then we opened, I think, February 14th or 15th at Shenandoah. So you've only got 4 weeks to get them ready. Those extra six sessions in the beginning were really important. And then this past year, we built a dome on campus, which opened in February. Critically important for us from a developmental standpoint. We used to be in a gym, and now we're in a full-size football field with a dome over it. We were able to long toss more. We were able to go live more. We were able to see a lot more early live repetitions early. That really benefited us. I thought we were ready earlier than we had been in the past because of that.
Yeah, just the ability to stretch out as a pitcher. Even position players need to play long toss, like, and just get stretched out.
Yeah, and so that's a lost art now, right? And there's a lot. I mean, we could talk, you know, for probably six shows about long toss and the benefits of that. But again, I'm kind of old school. I like long toss. I believe in long toss. I think some guys benefit from it. And yeah, position players too. I think there's some value in that. Again, when you're playing eight games in 7 days at the end of the season, you got to figure out how to manage that. And the only way to figure that out is to put some stress on the arm, you know, earlier in the year and make sure that you're ready for it.
What do you feel like separates a good college player from the ones who have a hard time getting on the field or don't make it?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's something that we actually address first meeting with our freshmen is, to me, you're all really good. The difference is one of the main differences, can you separate what's going on the baseball field from the other things that are going on in your life? If you're in your chemistry class and thinking about what's going on at practice today, you're not going to be good in chemistry. If you're on the baseball field and thinking about the test that you need to study for tonight, you're probably not going to be good on the baseball field. If you're thinking about the fight you just had with your girlfriend, that's going to impact. So I think their ability to separate those things becomes critically important. And then the other thing that we talk about is your ability to make adjustments. With scouting now, with video now, everybody is going to find your weaknesses and they're going to attack your weaknesses. You need to be willing to adjust and you need to be able to adjust. And I think those two things lead to success. I think the guys that can do that quicker have a chance to have more success sooner.
How early are you starting in the fall with them then on your, because you guys are running action-oriented offense. So how early in the fall are you getting going into that?
Pretty quick. So our practices are designed differently too. Like all of our mechanical and hitting work and stuff like that to me gets done in the cages. We never take batting practice on the field. Anytime we do anything offensive on the field, it's always situational oriented. So we're working on all the things that we put in. And then I still believe in bunting. We bunt a lot, and I believe in it. That's day one of our offensive fall practice. and we teach guys how to bunt, and it's amazing to me, amazing how many 17-year-olds have never been taught how to bunt before.
Where do you start with them on bunting? Where do you start in your progression? You start with sack, you start with drag, you start with push. Where do you start?
We start with the mental part of it. The mental part is, hey, if you're the four hitter and we're in a tight game and the three hitter gets on, you have to be in the on-deck circle knowing that you potentially could bunt. And if you know that you potentially could bunt, I think that gives you a better chance. If you're in the box and you're just getting the bunt sign, you're probably going to be pissed off that you're getting the bunt sign, and you're probably not going to be as effective. So we talk about the mental side of it before we talk about the physical. When we do get to the physical, we work on the sack. I think everything kind of goes off of that, you know, footwork and what we want guys, you know, doing and the specific mechanics. But it's amazing to me how many guys have never sat through and just even listened to somebody talk about bunting. It's just not valued anymore.
Top hand catch is where we started. So I got that from Barry Bonds, honestly. Barry Bonds,
really?
He wasn't bunting, but that was one of Barry Bonds' lead up drills, is he would just try to catch with his top hand with his eyes close to the ball. And then we'd just add the barrel in with one hand, and then we'd go from there. But just simple things, because same thing. That's how I teach little kids how to bunt now. It's funny, I can teach a six-year-old to bunt in a couple sessions with just some of those simple drills. But then part of it is seeing it execute. That was anything offensively with our hitters, is I wanted to them see it happen before they got in the box, just to allow them to relax a little bit. Because I think that's a great point, because I think you have to see it before it actually happens.
Yeah, they talk about that all the time, like the visualization, and that's always an area. It's funny, I go to the conventions and you get up there and you listen to the Power Five guys talk about all the resources they have and the sports psychologists and these people and that people, and I'm like, wow, I wish we could do some of that. And then that visualization and the Ken Revizza stuff and all those things that, you know, those guys that came after him, I mean, that stuff to me is fascinating, but I'm not well versed in any of it. But then you make a point right there, it's maybe we are doing some of that indirectly, and I just don't know, because we are talking about the visualization part of it, and we are talking, we don't go into, you know, the heavy breathing, you know, as much as we probably should, or some of those other techniques that you can use as we should, but we do talk a lot about the visualization part of it, the mental part of it, being prepared for it, and then watching it happen and having success seeing it happen. You got to have some flexibility in your practice plans, right? Like, you set aside 10 minutes for bunting and it's not going well. Well, maybe you skip something else and spend 20 minutes doing bunting if it's that important to you to make sure that you're getting it right. And then other days, maybe you stop after 8 minutes because it's so bad and you're like, you know what, let's get away from this. Let's get a rest. Let's come back to it in a few days.
So. I'll put your guys up against anybody bunting wise, though, because I see a lot of teams that get to the postseason and try to execute bunting at that point because they need to and they can't do it because they haven't done it all year.
Yeah, it's just something that we value. And you know, I actually went back a few years ago. Somebody said, hey, you know, when you bunt, you're playing for one run. And I actually went back and took 14 years worth of data from us. And I was surprised 57% of the innings that we sacrificed bunted to get one run, we scored more than one run. And it's amazing what happens because you are just putting pressure on. So everybody that thinks, at our level anyway, that thinks, you know, you're just playing for a run, you couldn't be further from the truth. We're playing for more than that. A lot of times we're playing for a big inning, and you'd be surprised how many times people mess it up, and all of a sudden, you know, they don't even get an out out of it. So now you have multiple runners on base, and other things happen, and there's just so many good things that come out of it. But you need to be good at it, and you need to work at it.
And you said you're a gut feel guy. I was too on that. But the thing is, it's amazing what happens when the defense actually has to make plays and they know they're going to be put in those situations to make those plays. Makes the defense tight. Tightens the defense.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Even if you're ready for it, you know you've got to rush a throw. You know that all our guys can run. So even if it is a sack bunt situation, it's going to be bang, bang at first. So you need to be able to execute it. And then the way we do it, like, you need to be worried about that next runner too, because that next runner might take two bases, you know, or something else might happen. So we just think that there's so many things that can happen as a result. It was funny. We got to, I guess it was 2018. We got to the World Series, and they do a video presentation for all the teams prior to at the opening ceremony. And, you know, this team does this and that. And they were talking about the teams, and they had 85 team home runs, and which at our level is a big deal. And they got to us, and it was like we had 8 team home runs, and we had, you know, we led the nation in sack bunts, and our guys were all laughing at that. But I added up the amount of at-bats, and I was like, look, guys, the next year, I was like, we had 8 home runs in X amount of at-bats. It's just not going to happen for us. That's not the way that we're built. But if you execute these other things, now all of a sudden we have a better chance to be more consistent offensively. And, again, they got to buy into
them. And it just matters how many runs you score. Doesn't matter how you get them, just score runs. Doesn't matter how you get them, just score runs.
I love the 3-run homer, too, right? Yeah, it's really quick.
They all do.
It's really quick.
It's very sexy.
We just don't get a lot of guys that can do it. Yes.
For sure. You have to coach the team that you have, and you've done a tremendous job of that.
Thanks. And especially at playoff time, right? Like the guys that are pitching at playoff time are dudes, right? And they're not giving up 3-run homers, right? So you got to find different ways to beat them.
Do you have a fail forward moment, something you thought was going to sidetrack you or set you back, but looking at it now, it helped you move forward? Could be personal or professional.
So many things. There are really so many things that I could point to. I don't really even know how to answer that question best. The mentality of not doing well. I mean, the failures, right? And Jordan talks about that, and so many great athletes just talk about the failures and just being really careful that you don't make the ways that you fail, snowball and mentality. But I look back at my early days at Fitchburg. I was a really, really bad head coach when I started at Fitchburg. There were some things that I did that were just not good. And you got to learn from that. And fortunately, I have good enough relationships with some of those players that we can laugh at it now. But they remind me how bad I was.
What would you go back and change? If you could go back and do it all over again. By the way, I don't think anybody's good when they get their first head coaching job. I think we all make a ton of mistakes. What would you go back and tweak?
Some of my communication for sure is definitely something that I would do. But then the other big mistake that I think I made as a young coach was I had always thought that leadership was something that you either had or you didn't have. And I didn't spend a lot of time teaching leadership and coaching leadership. And at some point in my career, we had what I thought was poor leadership in the team year after year after year. And at one point, my assistant coaches came to me and said, yeah, because we don't teach it. We've got to do a better job teaching it. And we really took some time to do that and really teach our guys what we thought was going to help them. And that really changed things for us.
You do that in the classroom with them?
Yeah, we do it in the classroom. We do it on the field. It's something that we talk about from day one. Our players in 2010 helped design our current leadership model, and it's something that's evolved, but we do a number of different things with it. And one of the coolest things that's happened as a result is really two things. Guys use it in job interviews and absolutely kill with it. And then guys use it when they become managers in their professional careers and manipulate it to work in their avenues. And it, that's awesome to see. And it's not me. It's not what we designed. It's the players at the time. I think they have to internalize it, and it has to become important to them. But yeah, we start talking about that day one as well.
Love it. Tony Dungy was getting interviewed, and they said, hey, what do you feel like your number one strength is? He said, communication. They said, what do you feel like your number one weakness is? He said, communication for both.
I remember that. I remember that. I echo that.
For both.
I echo
I think
that.
We
yeah.
all do that. We all do that. You have any evening or morning routines you feel like help you? Do you have any consistent routines?
My morning routine is just to work out. I a long time ago in my career decided that I thought 6 a.m. workouts for student athletes were useless, and that's the time that I like to do it anyway. So my 30 to 45 minutes in the morning, or however long it takes me to do whatever I do, that just clears my mind for the day and kind of gets me ready and, kind of lines up whatever that I need to line up. And then, you know, by the time I shower and get to my desk, I feel like I'm just refreshed and ready to go.
How do you decide what you're going to do when you get in the gym?
I sometimes wing it on the way too. Like, I don't have a specific routine. I personally had battled back issues for forever, and so I stopped lifting weights, and that's really helped me. I don't do any weightlifting anymore. I do a lot more running and body weight stuff and so on and so forth. And at this time of year, I try not to go into the gym. I hate the gym. You know, it's just the same place all the time. So go for a walk or a run somewhere different today, or try and do something different.
I think outside's a big one. Getting outside if you can.
As I get older, I just try and
do
different things.
Outside. You can get outside and do it.
Yeah, unless it's really cold. The older I get, the more I hate the cold. So January, February, it gets tougher for me to get outside. But I try and stay outside and do as much as I can for as long as I can.
What would you like to see for Division III going forward?
Specifically baseball or Division III?
For baseball. Would there be any other tweaks? I mean, we talked about adjusting the schedule for you guys. Would there be any other tweaks you feel like would help the coaches and the student athletes?
It's hard to pick on the fall because they gave us some more flexibility in the fall. But I just think that the student athletes, you know, want to compete more in the fall. I'd like to see us get some more games in the fall and maybe just limit it to weekends, maybe 5 doubleheaders on weekends. And I just think there's they want that. And we're doing it anyway, right? We're inter-squatting anyway. So to see a different color uniform, and I realize that there are some budgetary implications to that. But I think if guys stay within reason, we can do it for a cost-affordable way. And then I just think that we really need to change the format at the World Series. The 4 games a day in one location puts pressure on a lot of different avenues. I mean, sometimes getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning for BP, and then that last game, sometimes you're leaving the stadium at 1-2 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it's the most important time of year, and we want to talk about student athlete experience. You're asking student athletes to do something that they haven't done all year. And then, we played 8 games in 7 days, and, there was one game, the game one against Whitewater in the 3-game series, which I love the 3-game series, but game one, each team threw 3 pitchers that weren't even throwing in conference games all year because nobody else was available. So I'd like to see us stretch it out to like the Division I or the Division II format where you get more days off and everybody's using their best guys to determine the national champion. I think that makes some sense.
Yeah, I agree with you on that. Let them enjoy it. And that part of it too, but you're keeping kids healthier and it makes for better games too.
Yeah, no question.
What are some final thoughts before I let you go?
Nothing. I really appreciate you having me on. I'm really thankful to so many people. Our players, our coaches, our administration, our school has been so supportive, but so many other people out there that have impacted my career in baseball and outside of baseball, some of the other coaches that I've worked with, some of the other coaches in our conference have really made me better, and I've learned from them. There's so many people that have really impacted what we've done, and so many people have reached out as a result of what we have done. It's just been really exciting. I'm hoping to enjoy it a little bit more before the guys get back on campus and we have to turn over, start thinking about next year. But there's just so many people that have impacted what we've done. I'm appreciative of all of them.
I think that's a thing that people don't realize that didn't get an opportunity to coach in college is how tight the coaches are on campus that you're at. Because you all pull for each other.
Yeah, we do. And the coaches here are great. And there's certain coaches that I go to and I watch them practice or I listen in on some of their meetings. And I've learned so many things from some of those guys. But also just the games that I watch. I mean, Tim Nyman at DeSales, we went head to head with DeSales for so many years. I've learned so many things from him and so many guys, Kevin Anderson down at Shenandoah and Brew at Marietta. I mean, there's just so many guys that you play over the years and you're like, yeah, I'd like to be able to do what they do. And then you start learning from those things and impact and inputting some of those things in your program. I think young coaches make a mistake for trying to think that they know everything, and you just got to, you know, take it all in. There's so much good information out there. You got to be true to yourself, and you definitely have to have a philosophy, but you've got to take pieces from everybody and put it into what you're doing, and you've got to be willing to stay flexible.
Thanks for your time, Pete. Enjoy the rest of the summer before school starts up. Appreciate you.
Thanks, Ryan. I really appreciate you having me on.
gotten to know Coach Egbert the last 2 years at the World Series. I've been impressed by the way they play the game. Congrats again to him and the Cougars program on their first national championship. Thanks again to Jim Richardson, John Litchfield, Zach Hale, Matt West, and Antonio Walker in the ABC office for all their help on the podcast. Feel free to reach out to me via email, rbrownlee@abca.org, Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok, coachb_abca, or direct message me via the MyABCA app. This is Ryan Brownlee signing off for the American Baseball Coaches Association. Thanks, and leave it better for those behind you.